The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Political scientists assume that democracy is safe when most people think it's functioning relatively well, when we have a deep commitment to the democratic system, and when politicians who violate some of the most basic rules and norms of democracy don't have any real power, don't have any real public support. And that just didn't seem to me to be true anymore. You saw for many decades across North America and Western Europe falling rates of political participation, deep disenchantment with particular governments. But you also saw something more than that. So when a colleague and I, Roberto Fora, started to look at how people actually feel about democracy, a lot of people said, you know what, I don't give a lot of importance to living in a democracy. I'm actually quite open to certain authoritarian alternatives to democracy, and I describe all of those figures in the book. But what was most worrying for me was that some of these figures were actually borne out in a more concrete way in the voting behavior.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 10th, 2018. Yasha Monk is a lecturer on government at Harvard University and a senior fellow in the political reform program at New America. He's also the author of the new book, The People Versus Democracy: Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Monk warned early that democracy in supposedly consolidated democracies was less stable than it looks. And in this book, he explores the consequences of that in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. He sat down with me in the Jungle Studio at Brookings for a wide-ranging conversation of the book and its implications. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 290, Yasha Monk, on populism and democracy. Let's start with the premise. What led you to write the book, and walk us through the basic argument?
Well, what led me to write the book is that I started to be very worried about the performance of American democracy and the performance of democracy in our countries, in Western Europe and elsewhere, a long time before it was fashionable. So I would shout from the rooftops that there's potentially a real danger to our democracy, and people looked at me a little bit like I was strange.
Okay, so let's stop there and look at you like you're strange, because pre-Trump, for the people who were kind of early to the game, sort of 2015, fear of the state of American democracy was really not a kind of fashionable thing. How did you get into this particular concern?
Well, one of the things I saw is that political scientists assume that democracy is safe when most people think it's functioning relatively well, when we have a deep commitment to the democratic system, and when politicians who violate some of the most basic rules and norms of democracy don't have any real power, don't have any real public support. And that just didn't seem to me to be true anymore. You saw for many decades across North America and Western Europe falling rates of political participation, deep disenchantment with particular governments. But you also saw something more than that. So when a colleague and I, Roberto Fora, started to look at how people actually feel about democracy, a lot of people said, you know what, I don't give a lot of importance to living in a democracy. I'm actually quite open to certain authoritarian alternatives to democracy, and I describe all of those figures in the book. But what was most worrying for me was that some of these figures were actually borne out in a more concrete way in the voting behavior. So in Europe, you saw the start of populist movements gaining a big share of vote, people who really didn't accept some of the basic rules of the system in the late 90s and early 2000s. And in the United States, they always, you know, failed at the primary stage. But you saw these quite extreme figures being very popular for long stretches during the primary season, and especially in the Republican Party. So looking at all of that together, I just thought that our absolute confidence that there would never be a threat to our political system was misplaced.
All right. So how would you characterize the threat in general? So we all say as a matter of descriptive faith at this point that, you know, there's a threat to democracy. Characterize it, both within the United States and more broadly.
Well, the threat, I think, is that people are so disappointed with the basic functioning of a system and so unsure that it's actually delivering for them, and we can talk about the reasons why they feel that way later on, that they are willing to vote for politicians who say the only way to solve the problems we now face is for you to give absolute trust in me, to really shake the system up, to break with all of those political democratic norms that people have kept to for a long time, to sweep aside all of the kinds of institutions that might hold me in check, because unless you do, I'm not going to be able to deliver for you. And so these people become quite popular. They're in one sense very democratic, but democratically elected in many places. I mean, in the United States, of course, Donald Trump had fewer votes than Hillary Clinton. But when you look at the governments in Poland and Hungary and so on, they do have support in a large part and often a majority of the population. But once they're in office, they start to undermine the independence of courts. They start to flood electoral commissions with their own stooges. They start to take over state media where those exist and force often the sale of private media into the hands of their political friends and relations. And once all of that thing happens, you no longer have free and fair elections. This is what's happening in Hungary, where we have elections coming up in which the Electoral Commission has levied huge fine on all the opposition parties so that they can essentially no longer campaign while declining to investigate the party of the sitting Prime Minister Viktor Orban. So what you see in Hungary, what you're starting to see in Poland, what you have already seen in Turkey and Russia, is people who are elected claiming that they care about the people and that they just want to make sure that voices are heard, taking on so much power that the people are no longer able to get rid of them.
So you were on to the decline of democracy before it was cool.
I'm a democracy hipster, yes.
Yeah. So then Trump gets elected and you write the book. Walk us through the book. What's the central argument here?
Well, what the book tries to do is to really give a more comprehensive account than is available elsewhere, I think, of the roots of this problem and some of the things we can do about it. So one of the central arguments in the book is that I think we need to look beyond the United States in order to understand how Donald Trump could arise, because we're seeing the development of quite similar populist movements in other countries. And we also need to look beyond the last couple of years, because as I've been describing, populists have been on the rise for a long time. In Europe, for example, the average vote share was 8% in 2000. It's 25% now. So this is a long-term phenomenon. And so we need to look at some of the causes that they have in common. And it seems to me there's at least three of those. The first is a stagnation of living standard for average citizens. So from 1945 to 1960, the living standard of the average American doubled. From 1960 to 1985, it doubled again. And since 1985, it's essentially been stagnant. That really changes how Americans think about politics. They used to say, you know what, I don't love those politicians in D.C. I don't completely trust them. But in the end, I'm twice as rich as my parents were. My kids are going to be twice as rich as me. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. And now a lot of them are saying, you know what? I've worked hard all of my life. I don't have much to show for it. Am I allowed to swear on your podcast, Ben?
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much. So let's throw some shit against the wall and see what sticks. How bad could things get?
That's pretty mild swearing.
I can try hard.
I thought you were going to do something more dramatic.
No,
say.
I'm so sorry.
So like, oh, what the fuck? Let's...
Do you want to keep going? The second thing is, and I think it's silly, but this has often been sort of in competition with each other for the last year or two. People have said, it's this, no, it's that. Well, all of the interesting social phenomena normally have more than one cause. So one of them is economic, but the other one obviously is cultural. You see that most democracies in Europe were founded as mono-ethnic, monocultural nations. People thought that they knew who belonged, and it was people who descended from a particular ethnic group. The reality was always a little bit more complicated, but there was a very strong conviction that people had, and they thought that the vast majority of people who lived in Germany in 1950, in Italy in 1950, in Sweden in 1950, in fact, did belong to that group. Well, now we've had 50, 60 years of immigration, a challenge to that notion of citizenship. Lots of people starting to accept and embrace, even celebrate, the fact that, of course, a German or a Swede can be black or brown, they can be Muslim or Hindu or Jewish. But there's also tremendous reaction against that. And since people have some kind of social status to lose here, since for a lot of people who didn't feel like they were the most important person in their country, it was heartening to be able to look at an immigrant or look at an ethnic minority and say, well, at least I'm better than them. It shouldn't be surprising that there is this resentment coming against that. And that's quite similar in the United States, which has obviously always been a multi-ethnic country. It has always had people of many different ethnic groups here, but it's also had a very strict racial hierarchy and a lot of injustice in its treatment of minorities. Now, I think what it's easy to lose out of sight in the era of Donald Trump is that we've made great progress there, that clearly the United States is a better place for most minorities to live today than 20 years ago, than 40 years ago, than 60 years ago. But again, there's strong resentment against that among the people who have something to lose from this equality. And the third thing is if the economic set of factors lead to a sort of groundswell of frustration and a lack of trust that the political system will actually deliver for people, and the more cultural side explains the form that this anger often takes, which is frequently for a kind of white nationalism and an exclusive nationalism. Then thirdly, the rise of social media and the internet makes it much easier for new voices, for more extreme voices, to break through the Overton window, this sort of set of things that afford to be acceptable in society. That can be good. It can lead to important social movements. It can empower the voices of people like the high schoolers in Parkland, Florida. But it can also obviously make it easier for extreme voices, for hateful voices to spread, for fake news to travel far and wide on the internet, and for extreme movements and candidates to organize themselves.
We use the word populism to describe a whole series of movements in lots of different countries that involve some combination of anti-globalization, racial tinge, sometimes outright racism, sometimes just kind of a little bit gentler kind of identity politics of the right, and laced always with this very deep frustration and anger at sort of mainstream parties and politics. And I guess my question is, how similar are these movements really, and how particularized to the countries in question? Is it right to link Marine Le Pen with Brexit, with Donald Trump, with Nigel Farage, with the five-star movement in Italy, with, which isn't quite even a right-wing movement. It's almost like more of a public relations firm. How much should we think of these movements as essentially a big international of white nationalism, and how much should we think of them as, something discrete to the places that they emerged from?
Well, so I think neither nor, actually, which is to say that it is striking that you see this whole wave of new politicians come along, and I think just looking at them in isolation from each other is a recipe for blindness. And perhaps, I've had some training in comparative politics, so my instinct is always to think that one of the best ways to understanding what's going on in one country is to see why the same thing is also happening in another country, or why the same thing is not happening in another country. And I think that's absolutely true here. I would add to your list, I think there's also left-wing populists. right? And I think they also share important traits. So why is that? Well, it's puzzling. You're right. I mean, you know, there are populists who are very left-wing on the economy, who want to redistribute a lot of money, who want to expand the welfare state. And there is populists who are very right-wing economically, who want to, you know, have a flat tax and get rid of the welfare state by and large. There are populists like Donald Trump, who doesn't seem to be especially fond of Muslims. And then there's populists like Recep Erdogan in Turkey, who doesn't seem to be especially fond of anybody who isn't a Muslim. So it's very easy to say, hey, what on earth do these guys have in common? Why do we even use this term? Well, I think there's an answer to that. And that answer is that they share a common political language and a common political imagination. It's amazing when you read their speeches. You know, there's certain variables you can drop in and out, the identity of the guy they hate, right? But otherwise, the speeches are strikingly similar to each other.
And what how would you characterize them?
Well, it is saying the only reason why we have problems in our country right now is that the politicians are corrupt and self-serving and cahoots with minorities. The solution is really easy, and normal average citizens basically know what the solution is. It's common sense. Now, I, the populist, am uniquely able to express and channel the voice of the people. I am your voice, as Donald Trump said at a Republican National Convention. So all you need to do is to elect me into high office, and I'll take care of everything. I'll take care of it. I'll take care of everything. Everything will be solved. Now, obviously, what happens when populists get into government is that things turn out to be a little more complicated. As Donald Trump says, who knew things could be so complicated? Who knew healthcare could be so complicated? Who knew the Middle East could be so complicated? Who knew negotiating nukes with Kim Jong-un might perhaps turn out to be a little complicated? Now, they don't want to say, hey, I've made false promises. Sorry about that. I'm not going to be able to deliver all of those things to you. So they start to blame. They start to say that they are not able to do their job because the media are liars and they're disloyal and they need to be regulated. They start to say that they cannot do their job because judges keep overstepping the bounds of their authority and they are un-American. You say that things like the Department of Justice and the FBI are a deep state, are enemies of the American people. And what you get over time is, unless they're resisted very effectively, a concentration of power in the hands of these authoritarian populists, which, as I was saying earlier, makes it very hard to get rid of them. And that's what you've seen play out in Turkey and Russia, in Venezuela. What you're starting to see happen in the Philippines and in Poland and in Hungary, and what may well happen in Western European and North American countries before long.
In the book, you make a distinction between liberalism without democracy and democracy without liberalism. Both are examples of the deconsolidation of liberal democracy, but they have strikingly different modalities. So what do they look like?
So first of all, I think to understand our political system, you have to understand that it has these two elements, liberalism and democracy, and it's helpful to keep them apart. Now, liberalism has nothing to do with liberal and conservative in the more sort of day-to-day political sense, I mean, the way in which I talk about liberals. George W. Bush is a liberal in the same way that Barack Obama is. So what do I mean by these terms? Well, liberalism is just the rule of law, the protection of individual and minority rights. It's a promise of individual self-determination, that you and I get to say what we want, do what we want, have relationships with who we want, without the state telling us what to do. Democracy literally means the rule of the demos, the rule of the people. I think it's helpful to hew somewhat close to that original meaning, which is that it's actually, in my terms, translating popular views into public policies. It is actually having a political system that's responsive to what people want. Now, my argument in the book, one of my arguments in the book, is that for a very long time, we've had a system of rights without democracy, of undemocratic liberalism, in which the rule of law was reasonably well adhered to. There's some obvious shortcomings, but individual rights and minority rights were mostly respected. But you had a huge role of money in politics, a revolving door between lobbyists and legislators, political elite that was more and more distant from ordinary people. And you also had the rise of all of these technocratic and bureaucratic institutions that took important decisions that were once reserved for Congress and the representatives of the people. So whether it's a growing role of the courts, of independent central banks, whether it's independent agencies from the EPA to the FCC, whether it's trade treaties, whether it's international organizations like the UN, you take all of those things together and a lot of issues have been taken out of democratic contestation. So look, when people say, and that's what a lot of the people who voted for Donald Trump did say, nobody's listening to us anyway. What we do and want doesn't make any difference. Well, you know what? They have a point, right? Sometimes populists can be right in their analysis. A stop clock is right about twice a day. I would say that populists in their analysis are right about four times a day. They're never right with their solutions, however. And so in part as a counter-reaction to the system of rights without democracy, you get the opposite. You get the populist who says, sweep aside all of this stuff. You don't need any of that. None of it is legitimate, which is far too simple. Just put all the power back into my hands, right? I'm going to return power to the people by speaking for them and being the only person who is considered legitimate in this political system. And then you get democracy without rights, which is to say majoritarian rule, which can often violate the rights of minorities, whether it's through the travel ban in the United States, the outlawing of minarets in the Swiss referendum, or the extreme treatment of Roma and Sinti in Hungary. But you also start to get violations against the rule of law and the separation of powers, which make liberal democracy, would make democracy without rights, always be in danger of degenerating into straight-out dictatorship.
So where, if you had to identify the prototypical example of liberalism without democracy and the prototypical example of democracy without liberalism, what are they?
Well, I think that the system of rights without effective democracy, with only partial democracy, is one that has taken root in most countries. I think the United States was a good example of that. To some degree, still is a good example of that. I think the European Union is also a good example of that.
Well, what do you mean without democracy? I mean, we have very effective electoral democracy that, you know, most people, you know, granted there are money in politics questions, but what's the evidence that that U.S. democracy is not functioning in the sense of a liberal democracy, other than that it elected Donald Trump and that you and I don't like him?
Well, it is functioning in the sense of a liberal democracy, which is to say that the liberal element is, at least until the election of Donald Trump, was quite well respected. It's now, I think, under attack in some key ways, but obviously still persists in very important ways as well. But I do think that there's a lot of great research, for example, by Marty Gillens and Benjamin Page at Princeton and Northwestern, respectively, to show that actually the views of ordinary people really don't have an impact on public policy in the United States. That looking at nearly 2,000 policy issues over a span of 30 years, the views of people towards the middle of the income distribution did not independently predict what would actually happen. Now, that I took it quite seriously. I mean, that's very concerning.
But is that an example of a failure of democracy, or is it an example of a failure of there being representative democracy that, in fact, does precisely what you say we need to do, which is to insulate certain policy decisions from sort of populist moods and flavors of the minute? Why is that a failure rather than precisely what you earlier described we need to do, which is to represent people without pretending to put power in individuals' hands in ways that will then be co-opted by demagogues?
Well, so first of all, when you look at those 2,000 policy issues, very few of them were problematic from a liberal point of view, which is to say that they didn't, in the bulk, violate individual rights or ask for a violation of separation of powers or anything like that. So I think it's a little too easy to say, oh, well, this is just the liberal element working. I think this is a real failure to heed legitimate policy preferences on behalf of the people. The larger point I would make is that inherent in our system is a promise that it can do both, that we live in a country where there's individual self-determination and collective self-rule, that we both have a political system that's actually responsive to what people want, and we manage to protect the separation of powers and the rights of individuals and so on and so forth. And what I'm seeing, and this is precisely what I mean by the two constitutive elements of liberal democracy starting to come apart, is a growing difficulty to keep that shop together. That because people are so disaffected with politics and are so willing to take the chance on a kind of strongman leader who says, just give me over power and trust me, I'm going to do fine for you, it is no longer possible to deliver both on some amount of real responsiveness to people's preferences and a protection of the rights of minorities. And part of the reason for that is the quite extreme views that people in many democracies have about minorities, about religious minorities, about immigrants, and so on. So when you have a majority of the Swiss people vote in a referendum to outlaw the building of minarets, so that the Swiss constitution now reads, and I quote, "There is freedom of religion in Switzerland, full stop. The building of minarets is forbidden, full stop," which doesn't make much sense. That shows the degree to which these two things that we've always claimed our political system does for people can no longer be done at the same time, which is concerning.
Okay, so what would be the example of the deconsolidation in the direction of democracy but not liberalism? If the United States is the, or Switzerland is the example of the other direction where you preserve liberalism and compromise on democracy, what's the counterexample?
Well, democracy but not liberalism is what the populists bring about. Right, so what you see in Venezuela, what you see in Poland and Hungary in the initial stages is precisely that. When you look at Poland at the moment, the government is undermining the independence of the Supreme Court, allowing itself to basically pick which judge is going to rule on which case throughout the lower courts, staffing formerly independent political institutions with its own cronies, all of the things basically what Donald Trump is trying to do relative to the stuff that you tend to talk about, Ben, which is the DOJ and the FBI and so on and so forth. Now, the government is also extremely popular. And when you ask people, most of them say, yeah, the Supreme Court was inefficient, we needed to reform it. Yeah, the judiciary is not really working well, let them do the judicial reform. So that, to me, is a case of illiberal democracy. It is translating what people want into policy. It has majority support. If the elections were coming up in the next months, the current government in Poland would win in a landslide. But it is also undermining freedom of speech, the independence of the media, separation of powers, the rule of law, in a way that may then eventually lead to the breakdown of liberal democracy, where you go from a liberal democracy to straight-out dictatorship.
One country, as you mentioned, that does have elections coming up soon is Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And Hungary is often cited as the prototype for this set of problems. I do not purport to know how popular Viktor Orban or the Fidesz is in Hungary. Do you believe that if a working majority of Hungarians wants a different alternative, that is available to them? Or has the process of deconsolidation and increasing illiberalism in Hungary gone so far that at this point you couldn't, by democratic means, get rid of Viktor Orban?
Well, there's two slightly separate questions here, right? So one is about, are there going to be free and fair elections in Hungary? And the answer is no, because for one, the political cronies of Viktor Orban, who sit in the Electoral Commission, as I mentioned earlier, have fined all of the opposition parties the exact extent of their campaign funding, so that they essentially are broke. Whereas the Fidesz party was never investigated, and they can campaign beautifully, right? You already have a change in the Hungarian media landscape in which the state TV, which is quite powerful there, is just a pure purveyor of government propaganda in a way it never was before. And a lot of the private media companies have been forced through various forms of political pressure to sell to close allies of Viktor Orban. Right? So you take those kinds of things and a few other developments together, and it's just not a fair campaign. Right? You have a very skewed playing field. That is not what democracy is supposed to look like. Okay. Now the question is, by all indications, for these reasons, Viktor Orban is reasonably popular in Hungary at the moment, and probably he can count the vote fairly and come out as a clear winner. The question is, well, what if that doesn't happen? what if against expectations, actually more people come out to vote against him?
Which is what happened in this local election the other day.
Which is what happened in a mayoral election. For, of course, that one he could afford to lose. There's a real question. I don't think anybody knows the answer about as to whether at that point the votes would or wouldn't be counted fairly. In Turkey, which has gone through a similar set of developments, there's quite strong indications, so far as I know, not proof, that the referendum result, which gave Recep Erdogan vastly expanded powers, with 51% of the votes, was not counted fairly, that there was some actual electoral manipulation going on. But I'm not an expert on Turkey, so I don't want to speak to that too much.
The book is entitled Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It.
And also the People versus Democracy, just so that people go to Amazon to buy the book. You know, when I search on it on Amazon, my name is Munk, and it always thinks that I type the U in mistake. So it always comes up with pictures of Burmese monks
who, I see.
You know, are against democracy, apparently. So don't be deterred. Don't be deterred.
So sorry, what I meant was the subtitle.
But thank you for doing that, because it allowed me to get a very shameless plug for the book.
Yes, and you all should go look at the pictures of Yasha dressed as a Buddhist monk.
Don't say that, Ben. In these days, that can get me into very serious trouble. I did not engage in cultural appropriation of this kind, for the record.
I want to focus on the phrase, how to save it. In this conversation, we have been talking almost entirely about the nature of the problem, both domestically and abroad. And I'm interested in what the prescriptive element is. What do you think a programmatic approach that is designed to save both democracy and liberalism looks like?
Well, I think it needs to, the reason why it's worth doing the real work of analysis and diagnosis is that you need to know what's wrong with you before you know what medicine to take. And so that's what I try to do in the book. Look, I think that there's a few things. One of them is to resist authoritarian populists when they're in government and to make sure they don't get elected if in your country they're not yet, right? What you see in countries like Poland and Hungary is that usually the opposition retains a reasonably fair chance of ousting the government the first time that populists stand for re-election, but the second or third time, as we've seen in Turkey, as we've seen in Russia, as we've seen in Venezuela, it starts to look pretty different. So in the United States, the course of making sure that an effective opposition wins at least one of the houses of Congress in the midterms and takes back the White House in 2020 is absolutely crucial, because, for we haven't mentioned his name very much today, I obviously think that Donald Trump does qualify as an authoritarian populist of this kind. The second thing is that we need to fix our political system in important ways. So we need to actually make sure that money has less of a role in politics, that campaign finance is reformed, that we perhaps even experiment with some new ways of involving people directly in the government through digital technologies and so on. But in the main, it's an answer to the three causes that I outlined. So on the economy, you know, moderate politicians have to show that they can deliver for people. The 2016 election was a contest between an extremist politics of change and a moderate politics of a status quo. And people chose the extremist not because they're all extremists, but because we want to change. We need to show people that we are able to put them in control. Well, anybody who cares about liberal democracy and who wants to defend this political system. And
so this is a program, from your point of view, of moderates of both the center and the right?
And the left, yeah.
Okay. So you're thinking about the middle 70% of the political spectrum.
I don't think the two-dimensional separation in politics is that useful. I think of politics as being divided across two different dimensions. One of them is liberal versus conservative, or left versus right, and the other one is liberal versus authoritarian, right? Now, I tend to think of myself as a left liberal, but I think the liberal authoritarian divide is much more important than the left-right divide. So I'm very happy to do business, as it were, with people who are right-wing liberals, who believe in the separation of powers, who believe in individual rights and so on and so forth, but have different ideas than I do about the economy. I'm not willing to do business with people who may, like me, be left, but who think it's fine to destroy our institutions and give up our freedoms and rights in order to accomplish, you know, the idea of nirvana. Now, to get back to the larger question, I think we need to demonstrate to people that they can have control of their own lives, that they don't have to be afraid of the future, that actually they're going to continue making material progress, that as in the past, they can rest confident that their children are going to be better off than them, and that they themselves will have a decent retirement. And they have to have a sense that the nation has control of its fate in the age of globalization and automation and so on and so forth. Now, I have a particular view of what those kinds of things mean. I think, you know, I'm in favor of globalization, I'm in favor of free trade and all of those things. I also think that we need to steer the effects of those much more proactively, do much more to ensure that rich individuals actually pay their taxes, that corporations pay a fair share of the taxes. But I also think, for example, that we need to do a lot to boost productivity, to invest a lot more in education, lifelong learning, so that American workers actually continue to use the skills to the fullest extent, which is no longer the case. I also think that we need to make it much easier for people to spend less on the absolute essentials of their lives, whether it's healthcare, whether it's housing, where I think we should build a lot more housing units, whether it's education. Now, look, it's perfectly possible for somebody to agree with the basic set of goals that I have and say I have different views about how to bring down housing costs, right? And that's fine. We can have a debate about that. But what's clear is that there are many more interesting ideas there, some of them developed at your lovely institution, Brookings, and other institutions up and down this road, that can actually give people the perspective of a politics that is not ideologically extremist, that is not authoritarian, but that would actually change things, that would actually improve things for them. So that's one set of things. The other set of things is responding to the slow transition from a monoethnic and monocultural to a multi-ethnic society, or at least in the United States, to an equal multi-ethnic society. And there we see on the one side the tremendous reaction against that with a white nationalism, an exclusive nationalism, that says we're going to talk about America, but it'll always be quite clear that if you're black or brown or Muslim or Hindu, you don't quite belong in our America. We obviously need to reject that with all of our might and fight for groups that are discriminated against and marginalized without any restrictions. At the same time, I think that some people on the more liberal end of the political spectrum, and I would include myself there, historically, are a little too uncomfortable with the idea of the nation, the idea of collective belonging. They think that nationalism is so dangerous that you should just overcome it altogether, or they celebrate every form of collective identity that's at the subnational level, but never want to celebrate the national one. To me, nationalism is a half-wild beast. And if we leave it on its own, the worst kinds of people are going to come and bait it until it runs wild and destroys us. So despite all of the dangers, which are real, I think that we need to domesticate nationalism. And that, to me, means embracing it, saying that there's something special about the nation, there's something special about that form of solidarity, that somebody in Maine and somebody in New Mexico can actually feel like they're part of a community of faith and that they care for each other and are willing to have different forms of solidarity with each other. But obviously, we insist that this is an exclusive nation, an inclusive nation of patriotism, which includes African Americans, Latinos, as well as whites, and people of no religion or who are Jewish or Hindu or Muslim, as well as Christians. And the third thing I would say is a response to the rise of the internet and of social media, which is not to censor them for some social pressure for Google, for Facebook and Twitter to more effectively stop the spread of hate that is against the community guidelines in any case, I think can be helpful. But it's to actually go back to fight for our political system. As Bill Goldstein, your colleague here, has pointed out, we barely teach civics in high schools anymore. We barely talk about what's good about our political system where I teach it in college at Harvard. And so I think saying, yes, there's many problems with our country and we should fight to overcome those, but also there's many things that are worth saving. The promise of having at the same time individual self-determination and collective self-rule is something truly noble that we should be proud of and that we should defend. And by the way, if you look around the world at Russia and Iran and China and Venezuela, you will see that for all of our problems, we still are one of the more just and one of the more livable countries in the world. I think that can change people's minds, and it's an urgent thing that all of us can do.
So I agree with a great deal of what you just said. I'm going to focus on areas where I don't know that I agree, because it's more interesting. I'm fascinated by your sense that campaign finance has a major role to play here, or is a significant part of the problem and therefore a significant part of the solution. Because one of the things about the list of countries that you've identified that are facing significant populist challenges is that they have radically different campaign finance systems. And so whatever the failure of the ruling elites to be representative of people's aspirations and desires, it seems to me, unless you focus particularly on the American context, it doesn't seem like campaign finance is a significant piece of that picture. And so my question is, aren't we using the phrase, or maybe aren't you using the phrase campaign finance as a kind of loose proxy for the idea that somehow the system should be more responsive to people and their desires, and that it is insufficiently responsive? And so in the U.S. context, we have this way of saying that's because big corporations and very rich individuals give all the money, and so the system responds to them. But if you're seeing the same thing play out in a dozen other countries that don't have that feature, doesn't it suggest we're overplaying the role of campaign finance in the discussion?
Yeah, and I don't remember exactly what I said. Certainly in my book, I'll go well beyond campaign finance. I mean, I do think that it's, you know, it is a driver of a lot of the specific anger in the United States that, you know, you need such vast sums of money that you have to raise from very rich people, and that not only does that facilitate tremendous political influence to special interests and to just the views that rich people happen to have, it also misshapes in a radical way how legislators see the world. I think sometimes when we think about campaign finance, we picture somebody who says, well, I got to take a vote in this particular industry now. I really think that I should be regulating them very strongly. But if I do, they're not going to give me money. So I'm going to go against my conscience right now and vote down this bill. I'm sure there's cases for that. But by and large, I don't think that's how human psychology or how the political system works. I think what people tend to say is, you know, they spend half of their time with these lobbyists and those donors, right? And so they come to understand the worries and the problems. They don't have the same commensurate understanding of the worries and the problems of the people who might be impacted by a special rule that helps those kinds of industries. And so they vote with a good conscience when they grant those favors to special interests. And so I think there's this much deeper way in which the system misshapes politicians' perceptions of what the voters care about and who they are and so on. There's forms of that in Europe, even for those different campaign finance laws, you're right. But I also think we need to go beyond that. I mean, one of the things, by the way, is around congressional capacity. So we need to make sure that Congress is an institution, and there's similar problems in some European countries, actually has the qualified staff and is able to pay them enough, but they can develop laws themselves rather than doing what they often do right now, which is just to go to lobbyists to take ready-written bills, because that lobbyist was their staffer 2 years ago, and he was good, which is why he got hired by a lobbyist, and he has a lot more experience than the people with an average experience of 15 months who were running around Capitol Hill, right? So that's one thing. There's also an even deeper thing, and I talk about the technocratic dilemma, the democratic dilemma in the book, which is that to some of those things, there's not going to be a good answer. And that's the thing that sort of most worries me. When you think about something like climate change, it's quite clear that we need to have a real political response to it. It's quite clear that that response has to involve as many countries in the world as possible. Well, how on earth are the world's politicians going to sit together and decide on the right course of action across the world in a way where you and I, as two random American citizens, still feel like that really reflects our views? And if we campaign and if we get active in our politics, then perhaps what we do changes. So many of the decisions we now take are such international cooperation or are so technically complex that it's just very difficult to have those decisions reflect what people's views are. Now, you might say, oh, so great, so who cares? So why is this a problem? And in a way, you're right. We need to make good decisions on those things. We need to have experts take some of those calls. We need to have an international cooperation.
No, but people do but need to feel represented by it.
Exactly. And managing to do those two things at the same time is a really big challenge. I think I have a bunch of really interesting solutions in the book to that. I don't have a simple answer.
So this is a good point on which to close. It seems to me that the issue that you're identifying there is that you want responsiveness to people's concerns, people's political engagement, but you don't want the responsiveness to take the form of angry populism that promises more than it will actually deliver. And so then turns to things that it can't plausibly deliver that channel the anger. I'm wondering, I was trying to do this over the last few days, think of a single example of a model in which that takes place, in which we successfully take the engagement and excitement and feeling of this speaks for me that populism represents and channels and applies it in constructive political formats. I was having trouble coming up with models of that. I'm curious whether you can think of governance structures that represent that in any sense.
I don't know if I have an exact answer to the question, but I do think of there's politicians who are quite gifted at channeling public anger, speaking in very blunt ways about the ways in which we have deep shortcomings in our political system, and then trying to convert that into politics that you may not agree with, that may not go far enough, but that are at first sight productive rather than destructive. I think Barack Obama was such a politician. I think part of the problem when he was in office is that he became less willing to express some of that anger, and that because of a deep veto points in the American political system and so on, you know, there wasn't a whole lot he could do as president. But I think when you think about the kind of vision that you laid out and the kind of way in which he talked, it was an effective example of that.
The book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Yascha Mounk, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, have you taken a moment to review the Lawfare podcast, rate the Lawfare podcast, and say nice things about the Lawfare podcast on whatever social media services you use? If not, please do so. We don't get funding from MeUndies or from Casper Mattresses. We only have you to spread the word. So please do that. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And of course, thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.